Fatherless Fanny by Anonymous. Chapter 4, Part 2. Lord Durham's handwriting was well known to her, and as the London postmark struck her eye, her fertile imagination presented the possibility of my brother's return to England on Lady Emily's account. Lady Petersfield had no idea that the unhappy pair were already united, but supposed that Lord Durham had been brought back by Emily's entreaties, and that the union might be cemented. There was nothing Lady Petersfield dreaded more than my brother's marrying, and she naturally concluded, as he was so much attached to Lady Emily, if she could but prevent the marriage, there would be little danger of his making another choice. Full of these ideas, therefore, the cruel woman carried my brother's letter to my father without breaking the seal, and imparting her sentiments to him upon the subject, left it to his own option whether he would read it or not. My father did not hesitate a moment, but tearing open the fatal letter, he soon became master of the carefully concealed secret. Good heavens, what a scene followed! I was sent for by my enraged parent, and loaded with every epithet anger could dictate or passion utter. In accents scarcely articulate from fury, he demanded the place of Lady Emily's retirement, and said he would not only disinherit, but instantly renounce me if I refused to satisfy him on that head. His threats had, however, no other effect than determining me to keep the secret inviolable. "Oh, my father," said I, throwing myself on my knees before him, "oh, my father, spare your unhappy daughter, and tempt her not to betray confiding friendship. I have solemnly sworn not to reveal to anyone the retreat of my unhappy sister, and I cannot break the sacred vow, though you were even cruel enough to fulfill your dreadful threats, and crush me beneath the weight of your vengeance." "Begone from my presence, serpent," said my father. "Begone, or I shall curse thee. How soon does a girl, when she is made the confidant of a romantic love story, lose all sense of duty, all shame of acting rebellious to her parents? You talk of friendship with your father's bitter enemy, and would prefer wounding his heart to the unpardonable crime of betraying this highly praised friend. But call her not your sister. At your peril, give her not that name. She is not, she cannot be that. No marriage can be good which is contracted by a minor, and I will take care your brother shall have no opportunity of renewing the contract. Begone to your apartment, girl, and in that retirement endeavour to recall to your perverted mind some sense of filial duty. I forbid you to leave your room until I withdraw the prohibition, and if you value your brother's happiness, attempt not to write to him." I obeyed my father's harsh mandate in silence, and retired slowly to my room, where I had the mortification of finding myself constantly attended and closely watched by Lady Petersfield's confidential friend, a creature who seemed to bear an instinctive hatred both to my brother and myself. In the meantime, my father wrote to Lord Durham, and informed him that having come to a knowledge of his most unpardonable misconduct in attaching himself to Lady Emily, he offered him his pardon on one condition only, namely, to return immediately to the continent, without attempting to see the object of his imprudent choice. "All efforts to obtain an interview," added my father, "will prove ineffectual, and only serve to expose you to my just resentment, as Lady Emily is now in her father's house, where I hope she will recover a proper sense of her duty, and no longer endeavour to seduce you from yours." The receipt of this letter, instead of intimidating my brother as it was intended to do, had a contrary effect, and determined him instantly to declare his marriage to both families and demand his wife. Full of this resolution, he wrote a letter to his father, acknowledging his fault in having taken a step of such importance without his sanction, but at the same time declaring that it was his fixed resolve to abide by the consequences, be they what they might, and live only for his Emily. "I am going," added he, "to demand her of her cruel father, for she shall no longer remain under his tyranny." This letter concluded with a most affecting entreaty for pardon, and an appeal to Lord Petersfield's parental feelings on behalf of his unfortunate son. As soon as my brother had dispatched this letter, he flew to Lord Summertown's and requested an interview with his lordship. To his surprise, he was immediately admitted. Lord Summertown received him with haughty coldness, but without any appearance of the violence he had expected. Encouraged by this, Lord Durham entered upon an immediate explanation of his marriage with Lady Emily, and in a mild but determined manner desired to be allowed to see her. "Who told you she was in my house?" asked Lord Summertown. "My father," replied Lord Durham. "The information is worthy the informer," rejoined the exasperated Earl, whose countenance now bore testimony to the rage that boiled within his bosom. "I will tell you what, young man," added he, in a voice scarcely articulate through stifled fury. "I will tell you what. You have injured me beyond the reach of remedy, and I will have vengeance. Remember, I tell you so. As to my daughter, she is not, nor ever shall be, your wife. Much sooner would I see her expire beneath the tortures of the rack than acknowledge such a union. Your boasted marriage is null and void, for you are both under age. Name it not again, for I will annul it." "My marriage is valid, and no power can annul it," replied Lord Durham. "We were married at our parish church, after having the banns published 3 times in the same place, according to the form prescribed. And had you, my lord, attended public worship as you ought to do, you would have had an opportunity of forbidding the banns, if the marriage did not meet with your approbation." "Vile traitor!" exclaimed Lord Summertown. "Begone from my presence!" And he rang the bell for the servants to turn my brother out, which they did, by force, with the most insolent brutality. "Remember," cried Lord Summertown, as the men were dragging my brother out, "remember, I will annul the marriage. There are more ways than one of doing it. No Trentham shall unite with my family and live." When my brother returned home, he wrote a letter to me, relating all that had passed at Lord Summertown's, and entreating me to inform him whether his Emily was indeed under her father's roof. My brother desired me to endeavor to soften his father in his favor, and to lend him what assistance I could in finding his beloved wife. The writing of this letter is the last action that was known of the unfortunate youth's life. A note had been given him whilst he was employed in it, and as soon as he had finished it, he took his hat and went out. His servant waited up for him until the dawn of day, and felt great alarm at his staying out, as it was very unusual with my brother to do so. When the porter got up, Lord Durham's valet went to bed, and having slept till 9 o'clock, found his anxiety greatly increased when he learned that his lord had not yet returned. My father, on the receipt of my brother's letter, had set immediately off for London, and arrived there late the same night. The house was in the utmost confusion when he alighted from his carriage, as the bleeding body of my brother had just been found in Kensington Gardens, and recently owned by his affectionate valet, whose anxiety for his master's safety had led him all over town in search of him. The report of a wounded gentleman being found in Kensington Gardens soon reached his ears, and he flew to the spot whither Lord Durham had been conveyed by the persons who found him, and where surgical aid had been administered, in vain. For although my dear brother showed signs of life for several hours after he was found, he never spoke, nor gave the least token of sensibility. And every glimmering of hope was fled, and the last faint struggle over, before poor Graham arrived, who instantly recognized his beloved master when he looked upon his lifeless corpse, disfigured as it was by wounds and blood. And on searching his pockets narrowly, a note which had escaped the notice of the first examiners was found, which Lord Durham had received only a few minutes before he left his father's house, and which no doubt led him to the spot where he was murdered. The handwriting was an imitation of Lady Emily's, and the words were merely these: "Precisely at 5 o'clock this afternoon you will find a person at Kensington Garden Gate who will lead you to your faithful wife. Emily." A latent hope of reviving his dear lord, notwithstanding his lifeless appearance, and the opinion of the surgeon, had induced poor Graham to have my brother conveyed home, where every aid was immediately summoned that anxiety and affection could suggest. But human help was of no avail. The vital spark had fled, and the inanimate body was incapable of receiving succor. The fatal sentence had just been pronounced by the surgeons Graham's care had assembled at the moment of my father's arrival. It is impossible to describe the agony of that distracted parent when the fatal news was revealed to him. He had set out on his journey with sentiments of the most violent anger towards his son, and determined at all events to annul the marriage which was the cause of his displeasure, little expecting to find it forever set aside by a catastrophe so fatal. The circumstances of my poor brother's being discovered were extraordinary. Two men employed in the gardens had heard the report of two pistols whilst they were at the opposite side of the gardens. They both agreed that it was a duel, and made the best of their way towards the spot the sound appeared to come from. There was some time, however, before they found anything to confirm their suspicions. As it was a rainy day, no person was walking, and when they had looked in vain for some traces of the supposed duelists, they were about to abandon their opinion and return to the work, when one of them stumbled over something lying on the grass, and on stooping to examine what it was, found a pistol. This circumstance reviving their former suspicion, they made a diligent search, and soon afterwards discovered my unfortunate brother lying extended at the foot of a large tree, whose spreading branches had so darkened the spot that the long grass concealed him until the men were close to him. His hat was off, and lay at some distance from him, and a pistol, unloaded, lay close beside him. Some faint signs of life that appeared on a close examination induced the men to lift him from his cold bed and convey him to the nearest public house, though a fear for their own safety had well nigh deterred them from the charitable act, as the mysterious circumstances of his death rendered it but too probable that they might be suspected of murdering him. Their humanity triumphed over their fears, and they acted the part of the Good Samaritan. On their entrance in the public house, the men desired the landlord to examine the dear youth's pockets, when his purse was found, containing a considerable sum of money, and his watch, which was a gold repeater of great value, which proved beyond a doubt that he had not been robbed. From a fear of getting into trouble, the landlord of the public house where my brother lay had summoned the coroner with the utmost dispatch, and an inquest was held upon the body before it was cold. At this investigation it had been decided that the gentleman had been killed in a duel with some person unknown, as the two pistols being found at a distance from each other proved that he had not put an end to his own existence, and his property being untouched was a presumptive evidence that he had not fallen by the hand of a robber. The mournful ceremony was over before the arrival of Graham, who reprobated their precipitation in the strongest terms, exclaiming that he was sure his dear master was not dead, but had only fainted through loss of blood. He had his lord removed, therefore, as soon as a litter could be provided, with the tenderest caution. But, as I have already related, disappointment was the sad result of all the faithful creature's endeavours. The consequences of this mournful event was a serious fit of illness to my father, whose agonized feelings were too much for his constitution. He reproached himself incessantly with his son's death, believing his own severity had driven him on his ruin. Notwithstanding the circumstance of two pistols being found at a distance from each other, my father always thought that Lord Durham had killed himself, though the note found in his pocket by Graham but too plainly pointed out the mournful truth, and had left not a shadow of a doubt upon my mind that my brother had been trepanned by the vile forgery into the power of an assassin. Who that assassin was has never been discovered, though I must own my suspicions rested on one person only, either as the principal or at least the employer. My father sent for me the day after he took his bed, and endeavoured by his tenderness to atone for the harsh manner in which he had treated me. He mentioned his intentions of acknowledging Lady Durham and her infant, and sent me to the place of her concealment with a kind message to that purport. But alas, a new sorrow was prepared for me. The retreat of the unfortunate Emily had been discovered by her implacable father, who forcibly conveyed her to one of his own mansions in a distant country. The lovely creature had refused to part with her child, who was accordingly permitted to accompany her in her banishment. My father received the news of this fresh act of cruelty with real concern. He had rested his hopes of conciliating his uneasy conscience by showing to the beloved wife of his lamented son the deep penitence he felt for his former cruelty, and endeavouring to atone for it by every act of tenderness her forlorn situation required. This mournful satisfaction was, however, denied him, and he took on so heavily that his grief produced a train of disorders which soon became fatal. He survived his son only 13 months. During the whole of that melancholy period, I lived totally secluded from society. Lady Petersfield endeavoured in vain to displace me from my father's sick room. I was tenacious of my post as head nurse, and as my services appeared more agreeable to my unhappy parent than any other person's, all her manoeuvres were fallacious. When her ladyship found that I was stationary, she came less frequently into the apartment, and soon returned to her gay habits without concerning herself about the invalid, whom she represented as a hypochondriac to all her acquaintance. Indeed, her ladyship's spirits appeared better than ever after my dear brother's death. Her favourite point was obtained. Her son was now Lord Durham. She heard of my brother's marriage and that there was a child, but her indefatigable genius soon discovered that it was a daughter, and therefore not to be feared. During the whole time my father lived, I received no letter from Lady Durham, nor could I gain any access to her by all the stratagems I could devise. Various and tormenting were the reports spread abroad of that interesting creature. Sometimes I heard that she was in deep decline, at others that she had quite recovered her health and spirits, and was about to emerge from her retirement and become the ornament of Tone. I dared not mention these vague rumours to my father, whose spirits became weaker every day, and whose remorse was frequently beyond the control of reason. At length the awful moment arrived. The agonized frame could no longer support the painful struggle. My poor father died of a broken heart in his 49th year, and left me an isolated being without one friend to console me. I could not remain with Lady Petersfield. The sight of her was insupportable. I therefore removed, as soon as I decently could, to my Aunt Morrison's, where I remained until I married Lord Ellencourt, which event took place the ensuing year. The bustle of my marriage obliged me to mix more with the world, and by degrees I recovered a portion of my former spirits, yet still I heard nothing of my poor Emily that was satisfactory. She never appeared in public, and I had every reason to suppose she was a close prisoner in her father's gloomy mansion in Westmoreland. 7 years had elapsed without my obtaining any light upon the subject, when one day, taking up the newspaper, I was struck by reading the following paragraph. On Thursday died, at her father's seat in Westmoreland, Lady Emily Hinchinbrook, only daughter of the Earl of Somertown. Her ladyship had been long in a declining state. I was inexpressibly shocked. "Poor victim of an implacable revenge," said I. "Thou hast then escaped from thy dear dreary prison. But what, alas, is become of thy offspring?" The air of disclaiming her husband's title in announcing Lady Durham's death seemed to indicate that her child was no more. 8 years more elapsed before I was convinced that this idea was erroneous. I then received the following words, written in a beautiful small hand. "Dear Aunt, I have been taught to love you by the best of mothers, and I do love you with all my heart, although I have never been so happy as to see you. My grandfather has gone to Ireland on some business, and my kind governess has promised to take me to your house, if you will condescend to receive your dutiful and affectionate niece. Signed, Emily Trentham." I could not doubt that this letter came from my brother's child, and I was delighted beyond measure with the sweet idea of folding her to my bosom. My answer may be guessed, and the next day the sweet angel was introduced to me. I will not pretend to describe what I felt when I beheld the most striking likeness of my injured Seymour in the soft features of his lovely daughter. A more perfect beauty I never saw, nor a female so devoid of vanity. She seemed the very soul of affection, and capable of interesting the sternest heart in her favour. This opinion was confirmed by her governess, who assured me that Lady Emily had so won upon her grandfather that she believed his lordship loved no other being upon earth but herself. The sweet girl could stay but a short time with me, but we often renewed the pleasure we experienced in meeting during Lord Summertown's absence. These visits were, however, suspended at his return, and a letter now and then clandestinely exchanged was all our consolation under the privation. I did not see the dear Emily again for 2 years, and then I found her everything the fondest heart could wish in mind and person. But there was an air of melancholy about her that greatly distressed me, as it appeared unnatural to her. She blushed when I questioned her, and replied that she would some day lay open every thought of her heart to me, but at present she must be excused. Alas, I saw her no more from that period, for about this time her cruel grandfather died, and I at first hoped, when I heard the news, that the lovely girl's emancipation would follow. In this hope I was fatally mistaken. His son and successor, the present lord, was the counterpart of his father, and seemed to consider his cruelty as much an inheritance as his estate. In his hands the hapless Emily found another tyrant, and she was soon afterwards married, against her inclination, it is generally thought, to a nobleman whose name I shall not now mention, and went over with him to Ireland immediately. I am astonished she has never written to me since, although I have addressed several letters to her, supposing that the restraint she formerly suffered had now been agreeably changed to liberty. A murmur which has lately reached me respecting her present situation makes me very unhappy. But as it has not yet been confirmed, I will pass it over in silence. I hope, however, that my melancholy story has sufficiently impressed your mind with the truth of what I first advanced, that marriages contrary to the express prohibition of parents are generally unhappy and often fatal. End of chapter 4.